The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 123, The Sesame Street Show, from October 8th, 2007. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton, here with John Braun. Hi, John. How are you today?
Dave, I'm so excited. Today's a double holiday.
Double holiday? Why do you say that?
So I get a triple. Well, it's not only Columbus Day here in the U.S.,
right.
But it's also a Canadian Thanksgiving, as I found out from my Canadian colleagues at work.
Fascinating.
So we have at least a double holiday, which I think is just a okay. Hi, Canada.
There you go.
Thanks for being there.
And so why were you saying you triple holiday or something, or just double holiday?
Well, I'm thinking I should get paid at least triple.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
But working on a double holiday should get triple pay.
Right. That sounds interesting. this show, we've actually got a lot of great stuff in tonight's show. It's actually really
back
nice.
Back in sick, actually, and I'm sure you are too, because, man, that was just terrible last week. Traveling, I don't know about you.
That whole trip, Austin, it was actually great. We set up our new office down in Austin. Things went really, really well. We've got a great spot for the team down there. I couldn't be happier. This office building's really cool. In addition to being in an office with some other Web 2.0 companies, there's a couple of massage therapists, a couple of psychotherapists, and then the band Fastball actually rehearses in that building downstairs. And and every Wednesday, the first Wednesday of every month, they do a Wednesday night mixer where they, you know, people bring chips and drinks and you just kind of hang out in the lobby. And Joe King Carrasco, Austin legend, actually played in the lobby.
So they're
of our
meeting
office.
Your musical, psychological, and physiological needs. I mean that's just,
it doesn't get any better than that. And your advertising needs now with Backbeat Media being there. So it just doesn't get any better than that. it's nice to be back in the swing of things here. So let's get right to it and see if technology will let me read Neil's email here. Before I go into this, I did want to mention, you know, you can get the show notes, of course, at MacGeekGab.com. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the best email address to use. Sending email individually to me or John directly, while certainly valid if you have something not for the show, isn't the best place. If you send me an email for the show, John doesn't see it. So John isn't aware of your question and can't help out and can't prep for the show. So really, please do send a feedback@MacGeekGab.com. It's the right thing to do. Isn't that Wilford Brimley would say that, right? Yeah, there you go. So for very different reasons. And Neil Jones, Neil writes, my lessee D2 external firewire DVD-RW doesn't see disks anymore. When I last burned a disk, it was making a funny noise. So what I'm wondering is, can I pick up an inexpensive drive, internal or external, and put it into the lessee case? Firewire DVD-RW drives are more expensive and a little harder to find. And besides, I kind of want to try swapping it out. Thanks. So the answer is, yeah, there's no reason to buy an external drive. You can buy an internal drive. The only difference between an external drive and an internal drive is that the external drive is an internal drive with the case wrapped around it. And you'll have to excuse me. I just finished reading Dr. Seuss to my kids. So that may impact my
Sam. I am.
There you go. but right. Wouldn't you agree, John?
I'm with you. The only thing I would check, which may be a concern, is that as you're getting these higher powered, higher functioning drive units, like, you know, going from DVD to DVD, RW, all the additional protocols, we won't go in all of them, but you may just want to double check the power requirements of the enclosure. Burning, I don't think takes, you know, a huge amount of power. We're not talking, you know, 1.2 gigawatts, like, you get the reference. Anyways, but still, you want to make sure you're not bordering on the maximum power output of the enclosure or the power supply in the enclosure, because then the drive may act in weird ways, which these are the problems that people like Dave and I just hate, which are the ones that don't happen all the time. They kind of sort of happen in random times. So that's the only thing I would suggest in that case.
Got it. That makes good sense.
Now, well, we also had Well, I don't know if this applies, this utility that we kind of came up with here.
Yeah.
So one of our listeners wrote in, there's something called patchburn.de. I don't think it would be an issue here, though it couldn't hurt. But apparently, so Apple software comes with a certain set of external optical drives that it works with. And you can understand the issue here is that you don't want to support every drive in creation because you don't know the capabilities or the reliability, whatever. But there is this utility.
Lest the OS crash like Windows.
Yes. Well, I think Apple, typically, if they see it, if there's a device that they don't recognize as a valid device, they just don't see it, which is kind of rude. but anyway, so this utility will patch, apparently, the drivers of the Mac OS so that Apple utilities will see more drives than they normally would, which are the ones, you know. I mean, Apple doesn't, you know, develop their own drives. They just have select vendors that they like to work with. So the best bet is to get a drive that conforms to, you know, Apple's choice of optical drive, and then your Apple utilities will work. Other than that, you can try this patchburn utility, and that'll give you some more options.
There you go. And while we're at it, I know Neil was talking about just replacing a DVD RW drive with another DVD RW. Again, heeding John's concerns about power requirements, there's no reason beyond that you couldn't take an enclosure that, say, has a CD RW drive in it, take that drive out, go ahead and replace it with a DVD RW drive, and it should work just fine. So bear that in mind as you look through all your old cases and start deciding what to throw away and what to keep. Those cases can be valuable. In fact, you could even mount a hard drive in there. Of course, you'd have room on the face because there'd be an open hole in the faceplate from a CD RW drive. So.
Oh, well, duct tape will solve that.
That's right, MacGyver. All right, let's see what David has to ask.
I have an iPhoto question. I would like to use Aperture to manage my photos and have iPhoto access or share the Aperture library, which is now over 60 gigabytes. I realize that I can have Aperture share the iPhoto library, but then I cannot use the Vault feature within Aperture. I really like Aperture's editing features and Vault backup, but really like iPhoto 08 skimming and online printing options. Is there a way to do this? My name is David Fair.
All right. So I think there is a way to do this. We did some searching and found an article over on O'ReillyNet.com that talks about doing exactly this. Now, it's almost a year old, but I think it's still valid. You launch Aperture first. Obviously, make sure you're running updated versions of everything. Launch Aperture first, then launch iPhoto. In the file menu in iPhoto, you'll see an option called Show Aperture Library. And from there, you should be able to do this. We'll link to this article and hopefully that will head you down the right path. John, did you have anything to add to this? Or
no, other than that it's annoying that, you know, multiple apps from the same vendor that are both managing, which I would think are photos,
yeah,
would have a little checkbox maybe buried somewhere saying, you know, share photo library among apps.
Yeah.
So it seems a little hiccup probably because, you know, I guess they're working on getting them in sync, especially with the recent introduction. Well, I would imagine, hopefully, we would see an integration, you know, between the programs, so you don't have to do this little hack here.
The hokey pokey, as it were. Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to, well, a question from the VAP.
The VAP.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the show. Love it. I'm a recent switcher, just bought an iMac about a month ago, and I also do a podcast called the Vintage Airstream Podcast at thevap.com, VAP.com.
Ah.
And my first usage was recording the show and then editing it in GarageBand, which I never used before, of course. And I use a Marantz recorder to record my shows over Skype. And then I stuck the WAV file from the Marantz recorder using, you know, USB into the Mac. And then when I went and deleted the file, when I was done editing it off the Marantz recorder, the following week when I started recording the next show, I only had about, like, 30 minutes left. I didn't know what was going on. Turns out it left a hidden trash folder on the flash card in the Marantz recorder from the previous show, and didn't seem any real way to delete that. I only found it because I put it in my old Windows computer, and it saw it, and I was able to delete it all there so I could continue the show. So how do I work with flashcards to get everything deleted? You know, I mean, emptying the trash is kind of drastic because there might be stuff in there from other projects. So I found the same thing with my digital camera, plugging the card into the USB and deleting pictures off it were actually still on the card. There's got to be a way to work with flash drives without leaving stuff on it.
All right. Yeah, there are. In fact, usually the my recommendation with the Marantz unit would be delete the files on the unit. The unit is probably pickier than your Mac when it comes to how and why it needs to manage that flash card. So unless you have reason to manage it with your Mac, I would defer to managing the drive or the flash media with your Marantz unit. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I would agree with you on that because I've seen this, and actually I had an experience with this a little while ago with my prior phone, a Motorola V710, where if you took the, now they, I guess they've standardized on a name, and actually I have one on the way, a 1 gigabyte micro SD card for my phone, where before I had a 64 megabyte.
Wow.
They're growing. But anyway, so the problem was is that on the older phone, if you took the media, put it at the Mac, not known to many, and this is probably a good thing in general, but it would create these invisible directories like a .trash or I think a trash or, no, with .trash, yeah. And a few other things like DS store, you know, things describing the structure of the volume and stuff like that, which the Mac needs, and it makes them invisible so most OSs won't get upset. But when you're talking embedded devices and specialized devices like a Marantz, you know, audio player or a cell phone, they may say, oh my gosh, this isn't what I expect. And, you know, if the software doesn't do a very good job of error checking, it'll say, oh, I don't know what to do. Let me crash.
Nice.
And I've seen this. I saw it when, you know, I was first trying to learn how to transfer things from my older cell phone to the computer. I would put the media in the computer, copy the files, maybe, you know, as the listener, you know, said, delete things, put it back in the phone, and the phone would wake up and lock rock solid.
Nice.
Dead. Someone did come up with a script that would delete all these invisible files that the Mac would intentionally place there, but could confuse other OSs. So I think this is a, you know, agreeing with what you said is that you should not get too adventurous when you're using the Mac to manage a memory card that is married to another type of device, because they will, in all likelihood, have their own very specific and very picky way of deleting and adding and other things like that. I think a better thing, and I don't know how many devices do this, is where you plug it into the USB port, you plug the device in, and it appears as a drive, which to me is like a higher level where you won't have as much potential for disaster.
Actually, I'll disagree on that last point, because that's that's probably what he's doing. Or I've done this with other devices, and as soon as you mount it as a drive, the media player or camera or what have you just acts as a dumb device. So it will still inherit the DS store. And if you delete from the Finder, the trashes folder, the nice part is with an app like iPhoto, even though it sees it that way, it will still, iPhoto knows not to move it to the trash. It knows if you tell me to delete this stuff, I will delete it, you know, for good from the camera without having to go through that hokey pokey. So, Our first sponsor for tonight is Smile on My Mac with PDF Pen. Now, PDF Pen is an application that allows you to manipulate PDF files in many different ways. I use it all the time. You've heard me say this. If I need to sign a fax, I have a copy of my signature scanned. I will take the fax, paste my signature in, save it as a PDF, and then I can send it back out. I can refax it if I want, but I don't have to print it. Works great. If you've got multiple PDFs and you need to stitch them all together, PDF Pen is the way to go. You can actually pick and choose pages from different PDFs, pull them all together into one document, delete the ones you don't want, keep the ones you do, reorder things, good to go. PDF pen, very, very flexible. It's it's an app that I probably use on a regular basis, certainly more than two or three times a week. I always wind up having it open. PDF pen available from smileonmymac.com for $49.95, and well worth going to check out the trial. And if you use it, go ahead and buy it and support them. And that's a good thing all the way around. smileonmymac.com. And with that, we'll move on to Todd. And he's got a tip first and then a question second.
Gentlemen, this is Todd from Decatur, Illinois. Long-time listener, second-time caller. Last time I was Todd from Columbia. I got a smart aleck comment, a tip, and then a question. Last time I called in, you asked me if I would give my firstborn for the answer to the question, but I have to warn you, he's older than a year, so the warranty is run out. So, you know, take your chances. The tip, listening to show 120, I've run into the same problem with a USB printer attached to an iMac upstairs, and then over a wireless network when we're downstairs trying to access the printer from our laptop. What I do, and this takes a little bit of forethought, is I just go ahead and mount the iMac from upstairs as a volume on my desktop on the on our MacBook, and then it won't go away. It won't go to sleep. But of course, you have to remember to do that while the printer that's hooked up to, or the computer hooked up to the printer, is still awake. So. Again, takes a little forethought, but this kind of leads me into my question.
All right, let's talk about this little tip here, and then we'll answer the question. So, in fact, I ran into this in a backward scenario. The machine up here in the studio normally sits asleep. Occasionally, I'll mount the drive to open. We keep some of our accounting data on here because Lisa works up here during the day, and I keep wondering, why won't that computer go to sleep? And it's like, well, all of a sudden I realize, I've got a drive or a share mounted downstairs. And so that's why it's staying awake. And that certainly would work. I think, John, you had some concerns about the energy efficientness of it, but,
yeah,
there you go. Anything else to add to that before we move on?
Well, just, I mean, if you're running a machine when you don't need to, I mean, I would much prefer rather than using a computer as a, you know, print server, that you just buy a dedicated print server, because I could almost guarantee that it's going to use a few less watts than a computer. But
yeah. All right, let's see what Todd's question is.
I have an external hard drive, FireWire, 250 gigs, I think, but that's not important. I have that hooked up to the iMac upstairs, and so when I mount the volume on the laptop, you can run through and access all the files, no problem. But I was curious if there's a way to leave the external hard drive attached to the iMac and be able to access it from downstairs. Follow me so far? The reason I'm asking is because I'm in a situation where we're ordering some Final Cut Pro for my students, but the lab that they're in is really quite under hard drive space. Can I make that into a word?
Sure.
Okay, sure I did. Anyway, this is incredibly long, I just realized. And So we're looking to add some space to this lab, and I thought maybe that would be one solution, is to add a whole bunch of hard drives somewhere where students couldn't get their grubby little hands on them, but they could still access that space for video editing and such. Any help would be appreciated, and I think I've taken up enough of your time. Bye-bye.
All right. Yeah. So John and I talked through this, and absolutely, if you mount a drive on an external drive on a machine, you can then go ahead and connect to it, with one caveat. You'll see it in the list of shares available to you when you connect via Apple Share, if you are logging in as an administrator. Now, I'm guessing that Todd probably doesn't want his students connecting over the network with an administrator account and able to just see whatever they want to see. And so that kind of brought up an interesting discussion here. One solution is a piece of software from Hornware.com called SharePoints, which allows you to specify what is available to which user over Apple Share. And that, I think, would really help, Todd. And then, John, you actually had another actually kind of interesting idea.
Yeah, well, I was considering, so one of the protocols, Apple, especially with Unix roots now, supports a number of protocols, and one of them is FTP. Now, as Dave, I believe, accurately noted when we were kicking this around, FTP, the normal FTP client on the Mac, doesn't...
The Finder, anyway.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Through the Finder, isn't that great? And it really doesn't support two-way communication, but then... What I did is poke around the line, and this is an FTP program that I've had to use on occasion called Crush FTP. It's a FTP server, but what it offers is something called WebDAV, which both Dave and I think are familiar with, but it's basically offering a hard drive through a port 80 HTTP-like connection, which is nice because unlike FTP, which gets kind of weird with port requirements and passive and stuff like that, WebDAV is fairly straightforward, and it's also built into Mac OS X because iDisk, last I heard, also uses WebDAV as the protocol for both reading and writing data to the network disk. So that's another option that we'll link to.
There you go. All right. Moving on to Tim. I'm a little confused by this, but we'll let it roll.
At MGG. Hey, I love the show. I listen to it every week. I was just listening to episode 121, and you guys are talking about FireWire drive and disconnecting it, and the guy, I guess, I forget who, but he disconnected his FireWire drive, and now it's not working because he disconnected it while it was doing something. I seem to remember when FireWire first came out that people were actually demonstrating this, where you would disconnect the FireWire drive as it was transferring files, and it wouldn't do anything. It would just pause, and then you could plug the FireWire drive back into your computer, and it would resume transferring the file. And I've seen this being demonstrated. Also, it was even demonstrated where a video was running off a FireWire drive, and it was disconnected, and the video just paused, and then you plugged it back in, and the video resumed. So, what's going on? What happened to FireWire drives to where it was no problem disconnecting it while it was transferring files? Now, it's a big issue. Just wondering. Love the show, and I'd love to hear an answer.
I don't really have an answer for this, John. I mean,
what are you talking about?
Yeah, never have I seen any operating system be overly ecstatic about you yanking a drive from underneath it. Now, we've all seen where OS X and OS 9 prior and Windows will all complain if you have a drive mounted and you just disconnect it without, you know, in the Mac dragging it to the trash, which dismounts it, or in Windows using that kooky little device manager, you know, thing where you can tell it, yeah, go ahead and disconnect.
Yeah.
So while I'm sure FireWire as a spec supports streaming and dropouts and then resuming, I've never seen the OS support it. Have you, John?
Not recent OSs. I mean, even in the past. I mean, yes, you could write your device driver or hardware driver or, you know, FireWire or USB, whatever driver, to be very persistent when something goes away, because in theory, as long as you remember what you just did and you know what's going to happen next, then data was not, you know, tragically lost in a cache on the disk, in which case, well, you know.
Sayonara.
You could. I mean, just like communication protocols over the modem. I mean, you and I fondly remember, Dave, where over the modem, if a packet was garbled, it would try again and try again. Though that was, you know, orders of magnitude slower than memory or a hard drive, which is,
oh, wow,
you know, a pretty zippy device. I mean, we're talking in, you know, milliseconds or less of response time. So when something bad happens, it's usually pretty, you know, vocal very quickly about it, like, you know, Mac OS, which says, you disconnected the drive, dum-dum.
Yeah.
Please don't do that again. which is still one of my pet peeves. We had a discussion about this before. It shouldn't happen, but it does. But it would require a major rewrite of all hardware drivers to accommodate my little peeve there. So we'll wait.
Okay. Well, you can keep peeve as a pet for a while.
On that, but I think I do recall seeing very quickly an old Apple was demoing a big network login type of deal at one of the prior Macworlds or Mac show where they showed a big array of screens hooked up, and I think they did try to demonstrate that the network connection was robust. They would pull the plug out and everything would stop, and then they plug it back in. So in theory, that's and I think this is more wishful thinking, that that's the way things should work. And, no, and I think to a certain extent, networking, yeah.
Yeah, networking, I've seen this, of course. Yeah, and we've all seen it. You know, you're watching a stream of something, and then for whatever reason, the stream gets interrupted. Even if your network connection's still good, the stream gets, garbled or whatever, and it pauses and then resumes. I can see where this came from here, but I've never seen it with a.
It's not totally crazy.
Yeah, it's not totally crazy. That's right.
But we got a ways to go until, those catastrophes can be averted.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Ben has an interesting question that I think will lead into some strange discussion. So.
Hey guys, first time caller. My name's Ben. I've got a new iPod Classic. It's an 80 gig, and I'm a recent switcher. I also just bought one of the new iMacs. I enjoyed looking at all my photos on the iMac. I like setting up the slideshow to where I can listen to a particular tune and watch my photos drift by. Anyway, one of the features, I guess not a feature, but one of the things that worked when I had the iPod synced up to my laptop, a PC laptop, was that the photos were organized in the folders on my iPod. And now that I have synced it up with my new iMac and all my photos are in iPhoto, they all show up together and they're not separated out. So if I want to look at my photos, I have to look at them all together instead of in separate categories. Why don't events in my iPhoto transfer directly to the iPod so that I can look at it that way? I think it's a simpler question than I made it out to be. A little bit long-winded here, but anyway, you can reach.
All right, we'll reach you this way. So the new iPhoto supports events where you can tie pictures together with events. The iPod only syncs playlists, albums, right? So what you do is you create a smart album based on the event that you want to break out, and there you go. Then you've got that album synced to the iPod. And I think that's just, I mean, it's obviously a limitation of the way the iPod sync happens. They either haven't added by oversight the events, or by choice haven't added the events to the syncability of the iPod, but I think a smart album would be the answer here, and that should do it. You got any thoughts on that, John?
There's some weird. I heard there's some mini riots over the syncing of some other iPods to calendars and stuff. You may have heard of this, but no,
I know of no riots. I don't. Is there maybe this is the topic for future discussion, but no, I don't know of any riots happening.
No, there was something on the new iPod Touch where apparently it doesn't have full duplex calendar syncing.
Right. So, it's effectively an iPod, right? The iPod Touch is no different from any other iPod in that on any of my iPods, I can read my iCal calendars, but I cannot change them. I can't add anything to them. I can't delete. I can't modify. The iPod Touch is no different. The only reason people are in an uproar is because the iPod Touch shares the same form factor as the iPhone.
Phone, which lets you do these things.
So,
but still, people are. Yeah.
People.
People are.
Yeah.
Go.
Yeah, it's because it's got Safari on it, right? That's the thing. That's the thing that makes people and the fact that it looks like an iPhone at first blush, right? That's the thing that makes people think that, wow, it should have mail and all this other stuff. No. It's an iPod. You know, think about it that way and then it all makes sense.
But then I saw, all right, lawsuits, you got to stop, okay? The iPhone not having a replaceable battery, just deal with it. The iPhone price going down, another lawsuit, deal with it. And the iPhone getting bricked when you apply unauthorized changes to the device and then an Apple software update bricks it, deal with it. You know, it's all these, like, problems that aren't really problems unless you do something bad.
Yeah. That's right.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay,
I know just
mini
what
rant.
You're saying. Yeah, I like it.
But hey, Apple's a, you know, hey, they got some money.
Yeah. Stock's closing in on 170.
170? Oh my gosh.
Almost. No, it closed today at what, 167, almost 168. So.
But that you see the frequency of lawsuits increasing. You've noticed this.
Of course. They've got products that are popular. People are going to scream and yell.
Yep.
Our second sponsor for today's show is Audible, available at audible.com/MacGeekGab. Going to that link gets you a 14-day free trial of Audible Listener Gold and one free download. Anything you download from audible.com, you can listen to on your computer, your iPod, your Trio. You can burn to CD. You can even listen to it on a Windows machine if you have to. Books that they have there, they've got, I think, almost 40,000 titles now. How to Survive a Robot Uprising, The Search, How Google and Its Rivals Rewrote the Rules of Business and Transformed Our Culture. I Was, How I Invented the Personal Computer and Had Fun Along the Way, unabridged by, of course, the Woz himself. Stephen Levy's The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. And Alan Deutschman's The Second Coming of Steve Jobs, all available at audible.com/MacGeekGab. That's where you go not only to support the show, but to get your one free download. It's that link that you have to use, audible.com/MacGeekGab. And with that, we move on to Steve. Steve had an interesting question that kind of, well, it digs into the Unix roots here in OS X. He writes, I would like to enable change application focus on mouse over. That may not be the proper terminology, but you should get the gist of it. Basically, when I move my mouse over a window, I'd like the focus to change to that window rather than having to click on it. Also, I've Googled this to no avail. Can you help? We did. We did a little Googling, too. And really what I did was I went to macupdate.com and looked for mouse focus, because I believe that's what the Unix people called it back in the day.
Yes.
Okay. And I found
it. I don't like it, but go on.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't like it. It's very, very, well, if you've gotten used to the paradigm of being able to move your mouse wherever you want and not having the screen jump to life, then you won't like this. But there was a little extension for OS 9 that would let you do this if you liked. And there is something for OS 10 called Mondo Mouse from AtomicBird.com. And this is what it does. It among many, many other things, this Mondo Mouse goes and lets you do it. It's $15. I'm not sure if there's something else available for OS 10 that allows you to do mouse focus for free, or even perhaps something in the Aqua interface itself that there's some toggle hidden that you can flip. If anybody knows, let us know. But that's Mondo Mouse.
I just got to say, to me, some early, you know, GUI pioneers may be into that, but to me, you know, Apple Tab is the way to go between applications, and whatever app is frontmost, it just makes me makes my skin crawl thinking of that mode of operation, because it'd be responsive, but
it's responsive. I used it on a couple of Sun machines. I think SunOS did that. So
I think same here. I think and I guess you get used to it, but too responsive for my taste.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. All right. So Marcus writes in, and Marcus has referred back to what, two episodes ago, where John talked about iMovie 08 not installing on your 12-inch PowerBook because you have insufficient hardware, right?
Wait.
Yes, it's true.
Apple made it, though. It's nice.
Yeah. Well, I have insufficient hardware here on my Mirador Dual G4, I believe. I think it did the same thing.
And insufficient sounds so decisive, though. Just
it's marketing, man.
Mature.
They want you to buy a new machine.
Mature hardware.
Yes, mature. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, aging, long in the tooth. and so Marcus's G4 tower falls into the same category, and he found a fix out there. And essentially, and we'll link to the website. It's at techsanity.com, T-E-K-sanity.com. But there's a deeper link that we're linking to. And essentially what you're doing is tricking the installer. You go ahead and tell it change something from false to true, and then all of a sudden it'll work. And Marcus says, I successfully performed this tweak, and iMovie runs good, but not great, on my dual 1.42 gigahertz G4. I edit 720 by 576 PAL DV and H.264 without exhausting the CPU. Skimming the timeline is quite smooth. However, it takes overnight to export a project. So your previous version of iMovie does not get replaced, but placed in a folder named iMovie previous version, so you can alternate back and forth between both versions and get to experience the latest and greatest if you like. So thank you very much, Marcus. This all falls into the cool stuff we found category.
But this is Apple's looking out for you. That's why they did this. They didn't want you to suffer.
Really?
I guess. They didn't want him to suffer the, you know, overnight export of a video file.
Yeah, I'm sure they just made a call and said to heck with
it. But I understand what Apple's doing, definitely. So they probably have a room full of Macs, and they're like, you know, the experience on this older model is just not that great. Let's tell the installer to just not even think about it.
Yeah.
Though some people, like Marcus, would be happy with some of the features. But
I think that's what fine. Yeah, and that way Apple's not liable to support this for Marcus when he calls up and says, you know, I'm running on a dual G4 and it's being really
sluggish. Whoa, whoa.
Yeah, exactly.
buy a new Mac.
That's right. Yeah.
They put you in that queue.
They put you in that queue. Yeah. Oh, you want to talk to the Apple store. You called the wrong number. We started talking about ways of accessing Macs from remote again. And one thing we missed was a service called logmein.com. When we talked about this, back in show 56, I think, Logmein was not an option for the Mac. You could use it via the web interface to connect to a Windows machine, but the Mac couldn't be the host. That has changed. And Lyle and Matthias, among many others, wrote in and told us, yeah, this is now an option on the Mac, and I've actually used it. It works very well. You install a client on your Mac that then connects to the LogMeIn server. And I'll tell you, this thing pierces firewalls really, really well. It lets you, I've used it with Windows clients in the past. I don't do a whole lot of that anymore, but used it in the past. I use it with my dad's machine. And I've used it to connect to my own Macs from remote. So logmein.com is an awesome, awesome solution. And you can do it with one machine, for free. So there you go.
Nice.
I have my iMac G5 over at the house, John, the 20-inch iMac G5, first gen. And lately I'd been running some test software on it, and we'll leave it at that. And it started misbehaving. It would not sleep. As soon as it went to sleep, it would just shut down. And I thought, well, maybe this is this test software I'm running. And so, okay.
Yeah, I think you got to send me a copy of this test software you're speaking
of. No. So, anyway, then one day it just wouldn't turn on. I thought, oh, this isn't good. And so I tried all kinds of things and it just wouldn't turn on. And Michael Johnston and I started talking about it. Michael Johnston of iPhone Alley, of course. And of course, your AAC conversion guru. He's the one that's turned this show into
extra.
Thank you. And so he and I were hunting around about it, and I forget which one of us stumbled onto it, but there's the iMac G5 repair extension program that deals with this exact issue. And I have so few Mac desktops that I don't think in recent years I've ever taken a desktop in for, or had need to take a desktop in for repair. With laptops, you just mail it in. The box shows up. You pack it in the box. Off it goes. And so the iMac, they're like, oh, no, wait, you can't do that. That would cost us a fortune. So it's covered. I have AppleCare on it, but it would have been covered anyway because of this problem. There's a problem with the power supply. And so they said, you got to bring it into the Apple store. Well, the closest Apple store for me is either somewhere in Massachusetts or in Nashua. And
awesome.
Yeah, it's an hour, hour plus. I didn't want to do that. So I started looking at Apple service, Apple authorized Apple service specialists or whatever it is, and found one right here in Portsmouth called Mac Edge. These guys were top notch. And I just wanted to say they aren't paying me to do this. There's no quid pro quo here. I just wanted to say, as someone who went into this process being a snob, thinking, gosh, you know, I'd much rather take it to the Apple store than one of these specialists. I got to say, I was so pleased with the way these guys handled the repair. They did everything they could to turn it around quickly for me. And at that point, they didn't know who I was. I didn't, you know, drop the I'm Dave from TMO. We talked about that when I went and picked it up.
Does that work?
I don't know if it would have or not. Maybe it would. Maybe.
I've tried it. It doesn't work. I'm Dave from TMO when it doesn't.
Thanks for that. Yeah. That's only when they're putting the cuffs on you and stuffing you in the back of the car, though, right? I introduced myself when I went and picked it up. Lisa actually dropped the iMac off while I was traveling last week. So that's why I didn't get to meet him when I dropped it off. But yeah, I mean, they treated me at least at that point like I was any other customer and did a fantastic job. I highly recommend them and really any Apple specialist. You know, it's certainly worth checking them out. I'm sure there's some that might not be quite as good, but these guys are fantastic. And I just wanted to say, you know, don't necessarily be a snob about this stuff. There's no reason not to visit one of these guys.
I'd agree with you. Same here. If you go to Apple and I'll dig up the link, but I have to do this in the past with coworkers where they're like, where do I go? And I'm like, well, there's the Apple store and, you know, Farmington and New York City, and they're like, I don't want to do that. But there are certainly many, you know, authorized Apple repair shops which have access to the parts, and you know, they get the bulletins telling them what to do. So I'm with you because I'm in the same situation. I'm kind of a drive from a authorized Apple service center, and I've you know done this even for my portable.
So.
All right.
You want to talk about your floppy thing, John? I guess now you have to, don't you?
Yeah. So anyway, so a coworker, and just a little success story here. So a coworker gave me a floppy drive saying, and hi, Austin. Yes, I solved the problem, which he doesn't know yet, but he will by the time he hears this. So he gave me a floppy. Yes, a floppy. 1.4 megabyte. 3.5 inch. Apple was one of the pioneers of this format, or maybe not that capacity, but the, you know, 400K, I think it was, Dave, the first Mac.
400 was one of the first computers. And 800, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So anyways, he gave me a floppy, and he's like, oh, you know, I'm having problems reading this. I'm like, oh, well, that's kind of weird. Let's, you know, plug it in. So he gave me the external drive. I think it was a Mac Alley USB, probably 1.1 or 1.0 external drive. So now, the weird thing, and maybe you can't really figure this out, Dave, but some computers I would plug it into, and so one was G5, another was G4. Okay. Some machines, it would immediately say, I don't recognize this disk, eject or ignore. Other computers, which were around the same time frame, like a G5 at work, plugged it in, and it's like, okay, it was grinding the drive a bit, and finally it eventually mounted the disk, but it didn't show anything. It showed the disk, it showed the volume name of the floppy, but it showed no files. It showed some space used, which was, that's kind of interesting. Huh. So, and also if I ran disk utility would say master directory block damage. I'm like, okay. Well, fix it. And it's like, sorry, can't fix it. Oh, great.
Huh.
Well, fortunately, and so, you know, we have a few utilities Dave and I use to try to recover things, and in this case the winner is Data Rescue 2 for ProSoft. It was able to so actually what I did was something beforehand with Drive Genius, also from ProSoft, where I ran a sector editor. I'm like, you know, I can't believe that all the files in this disk are totally destroyed. There has to be something going on. You know, I would hear the drive grinding and moving the head, so I'm like, there has to be something going on here. And my best guess is the directory block on the drive got clobbered. due to some sort of mishap, which is like the worst place on the drive. But unfortunately, things like Data Rescue can kind of look around on the disk. And when I ran a sector editor, which is, for those who don't know, a utility that lets you look at what's on a disk block per block. And when I started seeing data that made sense, like, you know, parts of a text document and stuff I could read, I'm like, okay, all is not lost. So fortunately, Data Rescue is smart enough to look at the media and find hints as to what can make up a file. And fortunately, it was able to totally recover. Oddly enough, the files were in a trash or multiple trash folders. That was the weird thing.
Huh.
It recovered in one folder called trash and another called trashes. So apparently, some of these recovered files, and there were others elsewhere on the disk, where some of them were in the trash, which, you know, that's another thing. We were talking about this before. If the trash is specific to a disk. So if you put in a disk, remember this.
Right.
When you put in a disk, the trash on that disk is the trash at the moment. Once you eject that disk or get rid of it,
goes away.
The trash on that computer will not show those trash files anymore, because it's per disk. Trash is not a global thing, which is... Can be kind of weird.
It's an aggregate of all the disks that are plugged in or active.
Exactly.
Currently. So to kind of wrap that up, you were able to use a piece of software that was conceived, developed, and released to fix a medium that had been conceived, developed, released, and retired long before anything happened with that piece of software. I think that's actually pretty cool.
Well, it's cool. It was funny because some of the machines that initially barfed on the disk would say, "This is FAT16." Machines that worked said, "Oh, it's macOS Standard, which is a older school floppy-based type of disk formatting."
I like it.
Yeah.
So
I think you like ProSoft, Dave. I like ProSoft.
Oh, yeah.
And Data Rescue pulled through and pulled these files from the brink of death.
Interesting. That's good. That's good to hear. That's good to know. All right. So next week's show, John, you and I will have to talk offline here about scheduling, because next week's show is going to be late. I am, as you all know, flying to San Jose on Saturday to play with Paul Kent of IDG. It's a monumental birthday for him. And so I'm playing at the King's Head Pub with him in downtown Campbell on Saturday night. It should be a fun show. He's put together a bunch of his favorite musicians, and we're all kind of sitting in throughout the night. So should be a blast, and we'd love to see you there. So come on down. But that's going to put me late. I'm actually taking the red eye home next Monday night. Yeah.
Oh no.
But it's only one flight. I'm not doing the three flight fiasco that you did.
Okay.
But still, it's going to screw up the show. I don't know what I imagine we've got a backlog of questions here, so we'll address your questions. Send them in to macgeekgab.com, feedback@macgeekgab.com. Skype them to macgeekgab, and of course, dial. What's the number, John?
206-666-GEEK.
That's right, 4335. You've downloaded this show from CashFly Hosting, where you get all of the Mac Geek Gab podcasts. The podcast marketplace this month includes the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, one free download from Audible as long as you go to audible.com/MacGeekGab, and PDF Pen from SmileOnMyMac.com. And, go check out DealsOnTheWeb.com. We added, finally, Stephen Swift. I told you we brought on a new programmer recently.
Ah.
We added images to all of the deals and everything. It's so awesome. I am so psyched.
It's
like got a nice facelift. Everything looks really good. It's gooey and sticky, and I like it. It's excellent. So go check that out. We launched that today. I'm very happy about that. I think that's it. I guess it's time to rock this boat.
I'm going to celebrate Canadian Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Thanks, John.
What?
It sounded like the right thing to say. You have anything else to add?
Turkeys.
Do you think they eat tofurkey?
No, this is Canada.
What about turducken? Now, if you're a turducken running around in the woods this time of year, there's one thing you don't want to do.
It's kind of hard, but don't get caught.
Made up.